Accession number 9420, Reel 16.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 16. I wonder if you could tell me some more about what happened after the 1926 general strike and your political and trade union activities.
Well, of course, when I got settled down into the railway and had organised the engine repair shop, and I attended the branch meetings, and then, as I think I mentioned, I got elected as Secretary of Stratford No. 3 NUR branch of to carry on the business and make further recruitment of members into the union, because at that time, of course, we were in a bad odour because of the general strike all the way round from a organised workers' point of view. And what happened was that I was nominated then for the council when the annual elections come round, because in those days we had annual elections. We were elected every 3 years, every year, and there was one third of the council retired each year, as against now when it's the whole council's go in the one election every 3 years. And I was nominated, and I was in the strongest Tory ward in the borough, which was in the Stratford Broadway, right at where the town hall was situated, the education offices.
And what year would that be?
That was in 1933. And of course, at that time, the main Tory representative was the local jeweller, who was famous, or to say, not really notorious, for walking about the Broadway and going to his business every day in a top hat and frock coat, which was indicative of the time that we lived in there, which is a good pointer to you to, in the period we're speaking about. When you come to talk about 1933, of course, this was immediately post-war, you might say. We're just getting over it. The economical state of the country was at a very, very low ebb. There was a huge unemployment because of the discharge of all the wartime people. And as you can imagine, things were very, very bad. And we were struggling at that time. Fortunately, we had always been served by the Labour representatives. We had the four MPs. There was Jack Jones for Silvertown, Ben Gardner for Upton, Tom Groves for Stratford, and Bill Thorne for Plaistow. And he was the one, Bill Thorne, who had four wives, if you remember, or history will tell you. And Jack Jones, of course, he was the only MP that ever succeeded in vanquishing Lady Astor when she made some remark about his protruding belly, and she said this in Parliament, and of course he immediately got up, and he was a famous Irish wit, as you know. There was a book about his quips and sayings, and he said, "And I'm quite willing to place my belly against Lady Astor at any time she wishes." And she sat down absolutely speechless. History will tell you about that. Well, he was on the council at that time, and I went on there, and I've always thought I was very fortunate in having four councillors straight from Parliament coming to our council meetings and keeping us completely up to date with parliamentary affairs. and which, coupled with our local government efforts as a county borough, where at that time we owned the electricity, our own electricity department, our own tramways, our own fire brigade, and our own courts, and it was a county borough, of course, similar to the LCC, who were on the other side of Bow Bridge.
Did you win that election in 33 then?
Yes, I beat Crowe, Alderman Crowe, and much to his amazement and chagrin, I may say, because he was a peppery old gent. As a matter of fact, he was a sort of power of on his own. He, to give you an instance, when people went into his shop and bought anything at his shop, or even if they asked him to sign papers, documents, you know, for recommendations or the normal documents that usually have to be signed by some official dignity, he insisted that they put something in the box he had there for some charity or the other of his own. And he was a real tyrant in his own way, you know. And of course, it was a terrific shock to him when I beat him at the poll.
What do you attribute your victory to? Because you said it was a strong Tory ward. How did you come to win it?
Well, it was the reaction from the war, which was taking place really throughout England, if you remember. At that time, we had already had a six-month Labour government, which was a first attempt and didn't last very long. I forget how. I think it was about 6 months it lasted. I'm not sure. But then after that, of course, we really went to town, and the people were gradually turning then. Although the Tories had swept us out of power, people then were still getting the rehash or the result of the rebound from the war. You know, the sickening reaction of the hopelessness of unemployment and the effect, aftermath of war. That they then were beginning to turn to the Labour Party, and it began to show itself in the council elections. If you remember afterwards, I forget the date of the next general election when we got in, because I haven't kept a record of the dates, it's too far back now. And so I think that was the beginning when we started gradually taking the Tory seats from them, because we've always been Labour Council. We were a Labour-controlled council then, but it was the south of the borough where Keir Hardie first put up that had always remained far more solid Labour than us, who were having to beat down these Tory wards one after another. And when I went on the council, there was only 10 Tories left. That was even allowing for the defeat of Crowe and his two colleagues, because there was three candidates put up at each election, you see. And the result of it was that we looked at it, we made a bit of a joke about it, because we knocked off, every year we knocked off a Tory off of the elections, and we called them the 10 little nigger boys. There was only 10 left, and we gradually cleared them all off. Although we had one good fellow, the leader of the Tories, was a really good chap, Ken Collins. He was a very strong Catholic. He had a pub down at Upton Manor, which was in Bill Thorne's constituency. And he was a great bloke. He'd help anybody irrespective of what their political considerations were. And that's why I think everybody liked him, well, at least everybody who wasn't hate-conscious. And you always get hate-conscious people in politics. And it's a terrible thing. They forget democracy when they fall back on or give way to this hate consciousness, and I've tried to avoid it because I've seen how many unfortunate decent people have had to suffer from it, who have not been the same political persuasion as I am, and this is how it went. And
what about now? You were also elected chairman of the West Ham Trades Council. When did that happen? That was earlier.
Oh, yes, that was earlier on. I was a trade unionist before I was a councillor, as I've told you. You see, it was my NUR branch that nominating introduced and that. And then, of course, I was actually, I forget the year. It was very early on. I went into onto the Trades Council because I was nominated by the same branch of the NUR, Stratford No. 3, onto the Trades Council as a delegate. And then, of course, I made myself a nuisance, I suppose, or a loud mouth, if you like to call it like that. And I was into everything and very interested in trying to get some things put right in my own way, and which was in accordance with Labour policy and the trade union movement. And I was then elected as vice chairman and then as chairman. And we had a very big trades council. I've still got the minutes. I'll show them to you later on. When I retired in 1931, when I retired, because it was beginning to take a lot of jobs on, and I found it was a bit irksome for me to follow my council duties.
What did you have to do as chair of the Trades Council?
Well, of course, you know what the Trades Council is. It's composed of all trade unions in the neighbourhood of the area that it covers. And West Ham, being a very big borough, we had, as you can imagine, and it was a very industrial borough, and that's why we got thumped so much in the Second World War, because we had the railways and the docks and all industrial. We made everything in West Ham. As a matter of fact, when we had an exhibition later in the later years, we were proud of the fact that no one could name anything that West Ham didn't make, including silk. I didn't know that myself till we had the exhibition, but as you say, you go on to these things and you learn quite a lot. And we had a very, very strong Trades Council meeting, and of course it was divided a little at the time by the existence of what was known. We had then a very strong communist element, and they were supporting the National Unemployed Workers Movement, the NUWM, and that was in contradiction to the TUC Unemployed Workers Movement. I forget the official title of that, but of course I followed the official line, as I always have. I've never agreed with these mushroom growths and people, misfits I think sometimes, or misguided people who think they've got the answer to all the problems in a sentence, and set up these mushroom growths like we've got now with the militants at the present day. And so of course I use my influence. I got them the church, and an old vacated church mission hall at the bottom of my road that had been boarded up, and it was not used for anything, just behind the education offices in the Grove. And I got the council to agree that the unemployed have the use of that, irrespective of who they belong to, whether they were members of the NUWM or the official ones. And because it was, to me, unemployment was the main feature, and we had to look after the unemployed, try and improve their lot. And that was the main object, and I overcame my opposition to the NUWM and, you know, sort of left it out for the purpose of getting it. And then they spoiled that by barricading themselves in and demanding impossible demands, you know, for this, that and the other. And look, the same way as they're doing now, I mean, with the other crowd, and it's typical. And anyway, unfortunately, I had to stick to the official line. I was a TUC because the Trades Council, of course, was part of the official TUC movement, as you know. It's all part of it as it is today. And they're strong, not quite so strong today as they used to be, and they were then, because of the unemployed position, the economical and the national economy generally. And so I admit I was a bit of a tyrant, I suppose, because I recall on one occasion, when I say tyrant, I'm referring to my adherence to the rule book all the time. And I remember that old Bassett, who was the delegate, he was my vice chairman, as a matter of fact, Oh, Bassett, a big, great big fat fella he was, and he was the a delegate and an official in the Tailor and Garment Workers Union. And it was the rule, rigidly adhered to because of the upset of these unofficial movements and the tricks that someone were getting up to, that it was a rule that everybody had to show their card to the doorman, and they couldn't be admitted. Didn't matter whether we knew them or not. They had to bring their cards along because we did insisted, or I insisted, that everybody should be treated the same, that the officials as well as the delegates. And I remember on one night, it was a rainy night too, I'll never forget it, and old Bassett came along without his card. And the doorkeeper came in a bit of a hustle to me, and he said, Bill, he said, old Bassett, I forget his Christian name now, but he said he hasn't got his card with him. So I said, well, I'm sorry. I said, he'll have to go home and get it. I said, because, and we had average meetings of about 80, and we were always a packed meeting. We were a very lively crowd, and it was a treat to be able to preside over them. And you had to be on the watch because there was, obviously, there's always opposition to the officials. Well, no matter how good they are or how bad, there's always somebody thinks they're wrong. And, of course, I had the communists up against me. They were always after me, tripping me up if they got the chance. And I didn't mind that because that was democratic. As long as I did it fairly, constitutionally, it was okay. But, of course, I sent old Bassett, I sent him home. He went home. He wouldn't come back. And he complained about it after the next meeting. But the executive backed me and they said, Bill's only doing what we've laid down that should be the rule. And he was operating the rule. I know it was carrying it a bit strict, but then this is what we laid the rule down for. And we can't make distinctions between the ordinary delegate, who will immediately say that the officials can get away with it, but the delegates can't. So that was one instance of the type of attitude that I took on, whether I was wrong or not. I mean, neither ordinary here nor there, but that's what happened. That's history.
Had you got involved in the cooperative movement by then?
Yes, at that time, anything that that was officially recognised as part of the movement, and of course you know probably yourself that the Cooperative Party was a part of the National Council of Labour. There's a lot of our people, even the present day Labour members, even councillors, don't know what I found that out when I put a question up to ask any of our members if they knew what the National Council of Labour was, and it wasn't one of them knew it, didn't know what it consisted of. And of course it consists of the Labour Party, the TUC and the Cooperative Party.
Did you go to meetings of the co-op?
Oh yes, I was elected onto the political committee of the London Co-op, and of course I was on that right at that time. Alf Barnes was the cooperative member. As a matter of fact, he was the MP, a cooperative MP, and he was the chairman of the London Co-op Society's political committee. And he, as you probably know by history, that he was the first Labour Transport Minister. And of course, and that was in the early days of the political committee, when the Stratford Society became the London Society because it took in Edmonton, and it began to expand from there on. And I was on that right up all for years and years. I stayed on there I finished up as the vice chairman of that, and it was my turn to become the chairman. And I was so involved because I was on the council, and I was also a full-time trade union officer, and I was got my fingers in various organisations, and the Essex Territorial Association as well, in West Ham, and governor of various schools, including a college. And, of course, I felt that I couldn't continue with it, and when I was offered the chairmanship, you see, for my year of office, which was due. We used to do it on seniority basis. I turned it down on conditions that they allowed Gordon Chaffer, who was the then chairman and a very well-known journalist, carry on as chairman. They agreed to that, and of course, after that, I still carried on as an ordinary member. I wouldn't take the chairmanship on, but of course, at that time, during my later years on that committee, I had a very strong brush with them because of the way they manoeuvred for Alf Lomas.
Yeah, that's much later, though, isn't it? But getting back to the 20s and 30s, could you tell how you came to lose your job at Stratford?
On the railway. Oh, yes, well, of course, they were... I was becoming a thorn in their side, I think, because I was taking up cases and winning a fair number of them. And I think they got a bit annoyed, and they fetched a Boilermaker foreman down from the north, Doncaster, railway works at Doncaster, and I think they fetched him down especially to get me, because he had a reputation for being a bit of a bully. And, of course, he came down, and I only had two brushes with him officially on actual cases that I took up with him, and on each occasion I got his trousers down, and he didn't like it. And on two occasions I took him to the works manager, or second occasion, the brush I had, I took him to the works manager because I refused to accept his decision, and I won the day there. And he couldn't take it, and he was a very strong man. I'll give him full marks. He was a worthy opponent, and I enjoyed the brushes I had with him. And he used his influence to make an organisational change from the engine repair shop, where we used to do the engines that I was on with the Boilermaker work, to used to be a boiler shop where they actually constructed the boilers over at the other side of the works, which was a tremendous works in Stratford there. And the result of it was that he was using that as an excuse to dispense with men in the engine repair shop. But it was me that he was after. So in order to get at me, and he could only sack me on juniority, you know, the last in, first out, and he had to get rid of about 60 men to get me out, and he did that by sacking 5 and 6 a week. He was never revealed why he did it, but I mean, I was sufficiently versed then in organisation, trade unionism and representation to know what the game was. The writing was on the wall, because, as you know, throughout the country at that time, they were sacking those men who went on strike wherever they got the opportunity. The aftermath of that strike lasted for years, you know, 26 strike, and this was part of it. And it came down to my turn, and they put a wrong check number. My number then, I clearly remember it because it was so easy to remember. At that time, the official number was 8966. And I had my number changed about a fortnight before to 8996. And because they put my old number on instead of the new number they'd given me, I refused to accept the notice as an official notice. My officialdom again, you see, was always there. And I challenged this, and I even took it to the works manager. I wouldn't accept it off the Boilermaker foreman in the ERS. And he said, "You're being awkward, Gilman." He said, "Aren't you?" This was Major Baister, who was the works manager. Perfect gentleman he was, really, because he was very fair. I'd met him on other occasions. And of course, it was him who gave me the verdict in my favour when I had a go at this foreman. And He said, you know, you're splitting straws, Gilman. He said, because, you know, this notice was intended to be valid. He said, but it's just a simple clerical error. I said, I realise that, Mr. Baister. I said, but if I can't fight for my members, for myself, in the way that I fought for my members over these years, I said, you wouldn't think much of me yourself, would you? So he said, no, maybe I wouldn't, Gilman. He said, but look, he said, if I alter your number now, he said, to your correct number, he said, on this notice, and he'd got the notice which I took over to him, which I'd refused to accept, and he said, you leave a day later. He said, will you accept that? I said, yes, I'll accept. And I said, because then it will be in order. I said, that's all I'm here for. I'm challenging this. I said, I know I've got to go. I said, I know that, I forget his name, the Boilermaker foreman. I said, I know that he's determined to have me out. I said, ever since I won the two cases that I took up with him, the only two I ever had with him officially. So I said, I know I've got to go. And I said, I hope to come back and congratulate you on having discharged me. I said, because I'm hoping that another firm will recognise my ability more than the railway has done. Because I was quite cheeky with all this, you know. I mean, I wasn't insolent, but I used to give it to them straight. I think they appreciated some of them, you know. But anyway, funnily enough, I got this letter from the governor at Jimmy Miles, who was the manager of the cooperative, London Co-op Mutuality Club, offering me this job. And at the same post, I got a letter from Electrolux, which I'd written for representatives. They just started in England then, Electrolux, at that time. So you can check the dates up on their firm, if you like. Because on the same post, the same morning as I got Jimmy Miles' letter offering me the this collector's job, so I got a letter offering me an appointment at Warwick Street in London, or Warwick Road, I'm not
that
sure.
That was 1931.
Yes, And of course, I went up there and they offered me 6 weeks training and to pay me for it. And he was American. And I'd never had a grilling like I had off of them, you know, for the examination. There was only six of us. They only wanted... there wasn't. There was 12 of us all together. And he only wanted six representatives. And I was one of those that he chose at this 12 that they'd selected for interview. And I got a letter afterwards offering me the job as a representative. And I had to weigh up then whether I'd accept this collector's job in the London Co-op or Electrolux. And I had to make a decision. I made a decision that I'd go with the co-op because it was local and I knew it. And I thought to myself, well, this is what I've asked for and I'll check that. And this is what I chose. And from that time on, of course, as I say, I became a collector for the London Co-op.
That means you bought a book.
Mrs. Gray, her name was. She was a widow and she was moving, gone to live with relatives down the country, and she had no need for the book anymore, so she sold it and I bought it. And in a year I'd trebled the value of the book. I'd gone out and made it and raised the
value. How did you do that?
I went around canvassing for co-op members. I've got a list of the members of the co-op because we all had numbers at that time and they had the names and addresses of all their members.
And you were selling insurance, were you, to them?
No, only Mutuality Club. This was like the old credit system that they used to run in those days, you know, that you got vouchers. They bought vouchers off and went and spent them in the shop for goods. See, it's a well-known thing. They run it now. I forget the name of the big organisation that now runs it. Provident. The Provident Society that run it. And anyway, I took this job on.